Go, folks. I am now convening the Prosper Portland Budget Committee for the purpose of receiving the budget message. Today is Wednesday, May 13th, 2 p.m. All members of the Budget Committee members received copies of the budget on Friday, May 8th. Carla, could you please call the roll?
Hardesty?
Here.
Udaly?
Here.
Fritz?
Here.
Wheeler?
Here. Under Portland City Code and State Law, the City Council is holding this meeting electronically. All members of the Council are attending remotely by phone, and the City has made several avenues available for the public to listen to the audio broadcast of this meeting. The public can also provide written testimony to the Council by emailing the Council Clerk. The Council is taking these steps as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic and the need to limit in-person contact and promote physical distancing. The pandemic is an emergency that threatens the public health, safety, and welfare, which requires us to meet remotely by electronic communications. I'd like to thank everybody for their continued patience, flexibility, and understanding as we manage through this difficult situation to do the city's business. And now we will ask Kimberly Branham, the director of Prosper Portland, to kick us off presenting the budget message. Good afternoon, Director.
Good afternoon, Mayor and Commissioners. Our board chair, Tavo Cruz, is going to say a few remarks before we begin.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mayor Wheeler and Commissioners. I'm Tavo Cruz, chair of the Prosper Portland Board of Commissioners. We are pleased to be here virtually this afternoon to present the fiscal year 2020-21 proposed budget for your consideration. Since we reviewed the requested budget with Council on March 5th, Prosper Portland staff have been fully engaged in proactively leading Portland's response to the economic shock. This has required a number of quick actions and pivots in our work. Our proposed budget now recognizes near-term programmatic pivots, as well as planning for economic recovery, while also acknowledging the financial impact of the pandemic. On behalf of the board, I offer our thanks to the community partners and staff involved in the preparation of this budget, who spent considerable time between September and January drafting the budget and putting forth priorities for general funding, cannabis, and TIF funding as well. During this year's budget process, the advisory members and the board prioritized budget requests for anti-displacement initiatives and cannabis business development, in addition to key ongoing programs. We appreciate the investments in the mayor's proposed budget, and through existing resources and new funding, we believe we can deliver on these priorities with our partners. I am proud of the agency's work and look forward to continuing to strengthen our collaborative efforts with public, private, and community partners as we address the immediate impacts of the pandemic and begin the longer-term recovery process. And again, on behalf of the board, I would like to commend Executive Director Branham and her team for their excellent work and rapid response to this crisis. The Prosper Portland team, along with our partners, is resolute in its commitment to the equitable prosperity and future of this city. I would now like to hand the presentation over to Executive Director Kimberly Branham. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Cruz. Good afternoon, again, Mayor Wheeler and Commissioners. For the record, I'm Kimberly Branham, Executive Director of Prosper Portland, and I'm joined by my colleagues Lisa Abwaf, Tori Campbell, and Tony Barnes. I'm wondering if we can pull up the presentation. All right, so while that's moving forward, I'll just begin by saying how much we appreciate the opportunity to discuss our proposed budget with you this afternoon. I'm going to provide an overview of the budget and discuss how we're addressing the financial and economic impact of COVID and our high-level budget priorities. And then Tony and Lisa will share how those priorities show up in the programs that they lead with their teams. And finally, Tony Barnes is going to describe key components of our agency's long-term forecast. So while we do have 25 slides, we promise to move along at a good clip and we ensure that we will have plenty of time to answer your questions. All right, so next slide, please. Thank you. At a high level, of the $291 million in available resources this year, we anticipate up to $166 million in total expenditures. More than 90% of funding resources come from existing cash balances in TIF districts and tax increment finance that will be issued next year. General fund and cannabis resources of $7 million in ongoing and one-time represent approximately 2% of anticipated resources. However, they represent a substantial portion of our economic development and operating budget. To support this work, we employ a total of 86 full-time and limited-term employees, with the staff level for our three largest external-facing departments noted below. This is approximately three positions fewer than we included in the requested budget as a result of a cost containment agreement with our union partners. Next slide, please. We reviewed the draft budget with our Community Budget Committee, which met seven times over the course of the budget cycle and whose members represent a diverse array of geographic, industry-specific, and community stakeholders. Staff also reviewed specific TIF district requested budgets with 11 community and neighborhood organizations to receive input. We met two times in the past few weeks with our Community Budget Committee to share updated thinking in light of COVID's financial and economic impact. And you'll have a chance to hear from one of our co-chairs toward the end of the presentation to hear some of the committee's perspective. Next slide, please. As we all know, our financial picture and the city's economy have changed significantly since we submitted our requested budget in early February. So in the next few slides, I'm going to share the specific financial impacts reflected in the proposed budget, as well as some steps we've taken in the last few months to address the economic impact that has influenced our programmatic priorities. And while council is very well aware of these, we wanted to make sure that we were explicit about some of those programs for the general public. As reflected in the proposed budget and forecast, next slide, please. Revenue from tax increment finance resources remain unchanged. However, as a result of COVID-19, we anticipate that our program income will decline by approximately 30%, or $6 million per year for each of the next 3 years. The key drivers of this decline include the impact of deferring rent and loan payments to commercial tenants and borrowers in light of COVID-19, reduced demand for parking at the Convention Center Hotel Garage and other assets, and the interim closure of the Inn at the Convention Center. The budget also incorporates the 5% reduction in ongoing general fund resources and targeted increases in one-time programming. Next slide, please. In light of the financial impact, the proposed budget reflects an agreement reached with AFSCME Local 75, which includes 12 furlough days in the fiscal year for all non-managers making more than $75,000, a one-time salary reduction of 7.5% for all managers, cutting three unfilled positions, and reducing $150,000 from general administrative materials and services. Together, this creates a total savings of $1.2 million from personal and general overhead budgets, which is about a 6.5% savings from what was planned in the requested budget. Throughout 2021, we will prioritize key transactions, including selling the air rights above the Convention Center Hotel Garage and disposition of Centennial Mills, to try to offset some of the program income losses while achieving community objectives. And as the health of the economy and our financial picture become clear, we will continue to evaluate our workload, our positions, and our priorities to make necessary adjustments. Next slide, please. So shifting now to our external facing efforts, as City Council is well aware, over the past few months, we've developed an economic relief and stabilization framework and taken early actions with many partners. Guided by the Economic Recovery Task Force and City Council, our efforts are grounded in a commitment to prioritizing support for the most vulnerable, applying a racial equity lens, acting quickly and leveraging existing networks to do so, and partnering or advocating to increase the impact of our collective efforts. Building on this foundation, the framework includes four objectives. The first is to increase communication and connections to support. This has included establishing a central call center for small businesses and impacted individuals. We've mitigated economic hardship on impacted individuals, and this has included working with county and state partners. City Council imposed an eviction moratorium for residents, and collectively advocated for unemployment insurance regulation adjustment. The third objective is to help small businesses stay solvent and retain employees. This began with providing $150,000 to Epano to support J District and Old Town Chinatown businesses, and the launch of the Small Business Relief Fund with partners, which I'll touch on in just a minute. And of course, evaluating city business practices and redirecting available resources has included offering rent and loan payment deferrals by both the city and Prosper for borrowers and commercial tenants, as well as redirecting resources to invest in small businesses and household relief. Next slide, please. The Portland Small Business Relief Fund was launched with $1 million from the City Council, which was appropriated from City General Fund reserves, $1 million from the Enterprise Zone Community Contribution Fund, and nearly $400,000 in grant funding from the Oregon Community Foundation's Small Business Stabilization Fund, which was donated by a coalition of lenders and businesses with ties to the Oregon Bankers Association and the Portland Business Alliance. The fund provides a small grant or no interest loan to COVID-impacted small businesses with 50 employees or fewer. These funds were designed as a stopgap measure to help cover payroll, manage inventory, or make lease payments with the goal of enabling them to retain their business and employees. Next slide, please. Consistent with our guiding principles, the selection process was driven by a clear recognition that Black, Indigenous, and people of color, individuals with disabilities, and individuals experiencing poverty are often disproportionately affected in an economic crisis, and by a strong desire to ensure that the current crisis does not exacerbate existing inequities. The review committee therefore prioritized racial equity and other intersectional identities, along with the economic impact of the investments in the application selection process. Next slide, please. The demand for these resources cannot be overstated. The Portland Small Business Relief Fund received over 12,000 applications between the grant and loan programs, meaning that we had resources for approximately 3% of applicants. Nearly 8,800 businesses applied to the grant program. Of the 280 business owners who received funding, 90% identified as people of color and more than 60% identified as women. Grants of $2,500 went to 133 businesses with a single employee, many of whom had furloughed workers with the hopes of re-employment. Recipients ranged from childcare providers and healthcare services to beloved coffee houses, businesses that are truly essential to the fabric of the community. The remaining grants of $5,000 and $10,000 support businesses with multiple employees, many of which are taking extraordinary measures to support their employees. Next slide, please. In order to ensure equitable outcomes, we disaggregated awardees by race, ethnicity, geography, and other identities. This pie chart shows awardees by race and ethnicity for both the loan and grant recipients and demonstrates the diversity of recipients. Next slide, please. The map shows awardees by business location and demonstrates the citywide impact of the grants and loans. Next slide, please. The work of the task force and related programmatic adjustments have informed updates to the proposed budget and will continue to shape priorities in the coming year. Next slide, please. Prosper Portland's proposed budget implements programs and projects that are critical to ensuring an equitable economic recovery in the years ahead, and aligns with the overarching priority of building an equitable economy as articulated in our 2020 strategic plan. The budget builds on the networks, plans, and investments made over the first 5 years of the strategic plan implementation and directs the Inclusive Business Resource Network, the Neighborhood Prosperity Network, our Traded Sector Business Development, and our community-based action plans and tax increment finance districts towards economic stabilization, adaptation, and recovery. Next slide, please. In line with the relief and stabilization framework, as well as the strategic plan objectives, the budget seeks to deliver on four priorities. The first is household recovery and relief through increased access to support and employment for impacted individuals. The second is business stabilization and recovery by equitably retaining and creating, or in some cases, recreating business assets. The third is community partner stabilization and recovery to maintain the capacity of critical economic and workforce development partners, And the fourth is neighborhood stabilization and recovery through our community development investments to mitigate displacement. Next slide, please. Looking back to the most recent fiscal year for which we have complete annual data, you'll see the reach and impact of these programs. With nearly 3,500 jobs created, retained, or placements made through our economic development activities. Nearly 1,500 adult and youth served through our workforce development programs, with 61% of participants identifying as Black, Indigenous, people of color, or BIPOC. More than 1,000 businesses served through the Inclusive Business Resource Network, of which 72% identify as BIPOC and 58% as women, and 23% of construction funds contracted to certified firms, exceeding our goal of 20%, with 20% awarded to D, M, or WBE firms. We invested in nearly 50,000 square feet of affordable commercial space pilots across the city and provided 35 businesses with $1.2 million in Prosperity Investment Program grants, 68% of whom are BIPOC owned. And finally, we provided $1.5 million to 24 local nonprofit organizations through community livability grants. As we look forward, we hope to expand the reach of our workforce, business technical assistance, grants, and construction equity programs in the year ahead, given the programmatic pivots that you'll hear more about from Tori and Lisa next. Next slide, please. And with this, I'll pass it on to Tori Campbell, our Economic Development Director. Thank you.
Thank you, Kimberly. Good afternoon, commissioners. Good afternoon, Mayor. My name is Tori Campbell, Director of Economic Development at Prosper Portland. And I want to take the next couple of slides to share a little bit more around how we have really repositioned our programs to really be in a posture of supporting recovery with a strong equity lens. We realize in light of the changing landscape after the COVID-19, this was a must. So the first slide shows the work that we are doing within our entrepreneurship and community economic development teams. The four programs that are highlighted here we'll start with workforce. Our desire there is to pivot towards what we call light touch support. So that means providing light touch support within workforce navigation services, which are designed to help create a more localized opportunity to engage those who are seeking employment or wanting to improve upon skills. We know that in this season with just a tremendous drop off and loss of employment, this position and this role is going to be even more vital. We also know historically that oftentimes, particularly within Black and Indigenous communities, the numbers are oftentimes double what we experience just as a whole. And so we realize that this work is going to now more important than ever before. With respects to our Inclusive Business Resource Network, we've already shared briefly what our numbers were last year. We are increasing our light touch assistance, which basically allows for up to 5 hours of technical support, as opposed to traditionally our more long-term, which can be up to 30 hours. We still believe that will be necessary, but we really at this point want to touch more businesses across the city and providing guidance and assistance to navigate the new waters of COVID-19. We do also anticipate we will still provide very thoughtful and culturally responsive small business support, in particular to BIPOC communities and canvas firms, as well as focusing on repivoting how we do our work online with our Mercatus and our My People's Market. So in that instance, with Mercatus, which is an online platform that elevates the unique stories of entrepreneurs of color in our city, as well as it is a directory that helps with procurement opportunities, we want to boost that content, create more opportunities and business promotion to ensure that businesses are able to continue to find new markets to grow their business platform. We also have waiting in lieu, our My People's Market, eager to have it start as soon as we have the green light and are able to navigate phase three of the overall opening strategy for our state. The next area is our Small Business Relief Fund, as I already mentioned. We will continue to make efforts to find additional funding and support businesses as we can. The last area is working within our Neighborhood Prosperity Network and also our partnership with Venture Portland, who both provide complementary supports for commercial corridors within neighborhoods. And the goal there is to provide continued building the capacity of organizations who really represent the boots on the ground in terms of supporting both communities as well as the business community in their respective neighborhood. Next slide, please. Take a few moments to talk about our business and industry. Back in there. Yes, thank you. Sorry. Within our business and industry, we are focusing again. Our pivots are going to be increasing our firm and industry engagement. We've been doing that actively, but we'll continue to pick that up just to understand and ensure that services and connections are made available during this difficult time for businesses, particularly those that are vulnerable, wanting to help them continue to find ways to grow and support those firms. Next area we'll be focusing on during this time is startups. As many of you know, during our past recession, when employment became high, many turned to their own kind of inventions and innovations as entrepreneurs. And we anticipate that this will also happen again. And so we want to position ourselves by creating really equitable opportunities for startups, for founders who will call Portland home, as we want to support post-layoff company development, particularly in green cities and our athletic and outdoor clusters. Portland means progress. Again, a very important initiative. We really see this as very vital in this moment to reposition to a recession posture, which means including focusing on how employers can respond to the COVID-19 with a strong equity framework, as well as to really think about strategies to maximize intentional purchasing through our My People's Markets and our Portland Means Progress businesses. And we believe that that is going to be a very necessary component, a very positive way that businesses can support one another. And then last but not least is our enterprise zones. Again, we want to retool it in terms of just maximizing revenue while also reducing disqualifications for companies who might find themselves in straits that they didn't anticipate because of the COVID-19 virus. So those are the brief updates that I wanted to provide. And I will now pass it over to my colleague, Lisa.
Thanks, Tori.
Next slide, please. Thank you. Good afternoon, Mayor and Council. I'm Lisa Abwaff, Director of Development and Investment. Similar to the work that Tori's team has been undertaking with regards to our economic development activities, we're also working to pivot our TIF-based work to respond to both changing business needs and also just community and market realities given COVID-19 and ensuring an equity lens as we do so. So one of the first areas where we're doing that is we're working closely with the Bureau of Transportation, Portland Housing Bureau, and Bureau of Planning and Sustainability to ensure that transportation improvements can occur to improve safety and access for communities, while also making sure that it supports small businesses, particularly as they weather the COVID-19 impacts. And given an equity lens, we're particularly focused on our work in a coordinated fashion in East Portland, North Northeast, and in Central City kind of job centers in the Central East Side and South Waterfront. The good news is we are seeing ongoing demand for small business support through tools like our Prosperity Investment Program. We have $3 million committed for the coming year. And with COVID-19, we're coordinating closely with the listening sessions that Tori's team will be undertaking in the coming months to understand capital improvements that businesses will have to undertake to address physical distancing over the coming months. Our budget also reflects, and Kimberly spoke to this earlier on, that we provided immediate business loan relief and commercial property loan relief that we started in March to ensure that those benefits would pass through to local businesses and give them lease relief given the impacts to their operations. We anticipate similar needs over the coming year for many of the important community anchor nonprofits who have also been impacted, and we have identified $1.7 million available for community livability grants to continue that program. And we also know that COVID-19 has impacted local businesses' ability to pay their leases and access space. And so one of the first things we did was also provide lease deferments for properties for businesses that are in properties that Prosper itself owns. Looking forward, as we think about our community action plans and priorities, one of the new opportunities that we're starting to look at is ways that we could help stabilize property owners and businesses, either through property acquisition or other mechanisms that would help property owners keep their properties as they're looking at tenants who may not be able to pay their full leases and therefore they can't pay their full debt. And that will build upon the other work that we've already been undertaking for a couple of years now with regards to affordable commercial space at sites like Lentz Commons, 106th and Halsey, 10th and Yamhill, and Joyce Hotel. Next slide, please. We also know that one of the most direct ways that Prosper Portland can continue to support quality employment and MWBE and DBE businesses is through our construction-related projects. And our goal is to keep development and partner infrastructure projects moving forward. From those that are in construction, like projects that you see in the upper right, that's 106 in Halsey at Gateway, all the way through to the demo contracts that we are starting to let on Broadway Corridor, as well as supporting, making sure that there's a 2 to 3 year pipeline of projects that are ready to go as we're building capacity within the workforce and our small business providers on projects like the Cultural Business Hub that supports the North Northeast Community Development Initiative. It's one of the 5 goals of that initiative. And we anticipate issuing an RFI seeking potential projects and partners through that this coming summer, which would then lend itself to investments over the coming year. And with that, I think I will hand it back over to Tony.
Lisa, could I ask you a question before you disappear there?
Sure.
The projects that you have identified here, excluding Broadway Corridor, these are all projects that continue to move forward. Can you tell us how has this COVID crisis impacted those plans, if at all?
Yeah, it's a great question. To date, we have not heard any impacts to commercial development that was in process or underway. So unlike, I know we've had this conversation with the Housing Bureau that was tremendously impacted, the Housing Tax Credit Program has been impacted. We're not seeing that impact on the commercial side of the market. And so we're continuing to pursue pursue all of our projects. The one place I would say we have seen delays, but it's understandably so, is on some of our tenant improvements and some of our permitting. If we weren't kind of a priority project in BDS's roster, we have seen delays, but it's delaying by just a couple of months. It's not a significant delay.
All right, good. And before I call on Commissioner Hardesty, I'll just note the schematic there for the Broadway corridor really shows us how much things have changed in the last few months. When you look at that, it almost makes you cringe, doesn't it? Commissioner Hardesty, you have a question.
Thank you, Mayor. I was trying to patiently wait to the end, so you broke that mode. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I got into the vibe quickly.
I have a question about the RFQ that's going to go out around the Northeast Cultural Business Hub, mm-hmm. as well as the ongoing work around what we're calling now Central East Side. Maybe it's Broadway Quarter is what it used to be. Yeah, you're right. Mm-hmm. I didn't recognize that part of town, Mayor, so that may explain the confusion.
It doesn't exist yet.
No, it doesn't. And so my concern is if we are going to either do requests for information or requests for proposals, if we haven't fundamentally centered equity in those requests for proposals, then we will continue to get the weak proposals back that we get that don't center equity. And so I'm really curious as to how even your advertisement for people to respond will look different based on the City of Portland's commitment to centering frontline communities and making sure that those opportunities exist.
So I'm happy to, we welcome kind of any advice or thoughts. The picture in the upper left-hand corner is actually a picture with that very thought in mind, which was an opportunity for community-based organizations in North Northeast, as well as development firms, to do a meet and greet. And so we did that early on, just so that folks were both familiar with what the goals of the Cultural Business Hub were within the CBI, which is the concept of an African-American focused small business center and community anchor, so that the development community could hear that and understand what the opportunity was going to be, as well as to have nonprofits who are potentially interested in being tenants in the space able to engage with the development community.
Broadway Corridor will be the biggest development project the City of Portland has ever seen. Currently, there has not been opportunities for local contractors to benefit significantly from any activity with that project. So while I appreciate us continuing to have these aspirational goals, I think Tori said it best when he talked about, we know we will face a 30% unemployment rate coming out of this pandemic, which means that for communities of color, we're talking a 60% or more unemployment rate. And for young people, we're talking closer to a 95% unemployment rate. So if we at the city, we at Prosper, aren't thinking differently about how we're going to actually be able to bend that curve, we're going to end up with a very racially inequitable city once again.
Yes.
Commissioner Hardesty, I appreciate the comments, and I agree that particularly in a increasingly digital environment, engagement has its own challenges. And so we're, as part of the listening sessions, we are engaging with connected partners and thinking in new ways about how we do that engagement. But I do want to just note that for Broadway Corridor, the first two construction projects that we bid out both went to local MBE firms. And so I can send more details on that one, but we very intentionally crafted and sized those and did outreach with our partners in a way that ensured maximum opportunities. And so the first two were at local MBE firms.
Well, I'm very happy to hear that, Kimberly. Thank you. Because, you know, I've been a thorn in your side about this project. And I am hopeful that at the end of this project, we all will be proud of being much more thoughtful about how we make sure that we are centering those communities who have most been devastated and consistently don't benefit from these big projects. Thank you.
Thank you.
And before I call on Commissioner Fritz, if I could just chime in on this as well. From the very beginning conception of the development of the Broadway Corridor, it has been my top priority to make sure that we reset the way we do urban development in Portland, that people see this not only as the next great space, but one where everybody sees themselves in it, both in terms of how it's built, how it's procured, and the spaces and the amenities that are available in that district, including the housing. So equity has been front and center in every aspect of the planning and development of this project so far. And you have my commitment, Commissioner Hardesty, that it will continue to elevate equity and inclusion. And I believe we're close. We don't have any news, but we are getting closer. We are inching towards agreements, not only on, as Kimberly just mentioned, the early development phases and the demolition phases, but I believe we're also closer to some broader community agreements, and those conversations are ongoing. Commissioner Fritz.
Thank you, Mayor. Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for the presentation. I just have a quick question. Do you happen to know how tall that building in the bottom right is?
That's a good question. We would have to come back to you. I would bet it's about 70 feet. That's the Central East Side project.
I think she asked the vacancy, yeah. Lisa. Was that your question, Commissioner Fritz?
It was the height.
No, the height. This is for obviously in a different context, which will be coming up in a few weeks, but I just wanted to get your estimate as to how tall that building is. Yeah. Thank you.
And the only other thing I would add, just because I think it's something we will certainly be doing over the coming year, is at Broadway Corridor, and I apologize, I didn't register that was the project, is we're also looking at interim uses. So we're actively engaged with various chambers and various community-based organizations to understand how the space, once the buildings come down at Broadway Corridor, can be used on a temporary basis for many of our community-based partners to activate the space in a way that sends a message of equity.
It's a great opportunity.
All right, so now we're gonna have Tony walk us through a fairly sobering last few slides, and then we're happy to open it up for questions. Tony, are you there?
Yeah, thanks, Kimberly, and good afternoon, Mayor Wheeler and Council. I'm Tony Barnes, Finance Manager.
Afternoon.
wanted to end with an acknowledgement of, next slide, please. We wanted to end with an acknowledgement of some key elements and challenges in the five-year forecast and beyond. In order to ensure that Prosper Portland maintains the ability to support economic recovery and community resiliency, we continue to seek solutions with our board, city council, and partners in alignment with the goals of our 10-year financial sustainability plan. Next slide, please. So as a reminder, Prosper Portland's budget and forecast includes resources from 16 tax increment districts. This includes 6 neighborhood prosperity districts, shown in green, that will produce revenue through 2023, 4 expired TIF districts, shown in blue, that retain assets but won't produce new revenue, and 6 active districts, shown in yellow, which will issue new tax increment debt proceeds between 2021 and 2025. Next slide, please. As a result, in the next 5 years, Prosper anticipates approximately $600 million in resources, including about $228 million in beginning fund balance, with $373 million in new resources anticipated, as illustrated in the graph here over time. Of the new resources, about 60% comes from new TIF proceeds, 29% from program income, and 12% from general fund and other public resources like community development block grant. With these totals, there's about $122 million committed to the housing set aside, which is about 54% of the new TIF resources. So while significant resources remain available in the next few years, the TIF cliff is really squarely within the five-year forecast. Next slide, please. So in the coming year, we'll be working to address 2 key issues that, in addition to the TIF cliff, could have significant and thus programmatic implications. First, with River District, implementation of Broadway Corridor and the line of credit repayment, alongside updated forecasts for reduction in program income, causes significant balancing challenges to fund the district priorities, currently included in the five-year forecast. And then, secondly, the speed of recovery, availability of new public resources, and performance on key investments have a significant impact. It could mean up to about $23 million decrease in our forecast over the next 3 years, impacting the ability to fund certain projects, maintain level of service, and invest in ongoing lending and grant programs. This figure anticipates the significant program income reductions mentioned by Kimberly at the beginning of the presentation, and whether the impact is higher or lower will depend on the structure of key investments and the additional loan or lease deferrals that might move forward. And with there, I'd like to pause and take any questions on the five-year forecast.
Colleagues, any questions? Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you, Mayor. And thank you, Tony, for that sobering report. We've been knowing about this TIF cliff coming. And so I guess just knowing what we know about this cliff and resources coming, how will Prosper Portland readjust to this new reality? Because I can honestly say, I know the city won't have a free $23 million floating around in the next few years. And I know that all governmental budgets will be challenged, at least for the next couple of years. What's the plan to get to a place where the loss is minimal? What does the organization look like by the time we get to 2023, if this is the financial reality?
So I'll start. I think one of the reasons that I think like everyone, we anticipate that the economic hit will be significant and will be lasting, but we don't want to make any permanent decisions at this point without some additional information. So what we're going to be looking at really closely over the next year is our performance on the program income, because the financial sustainability plan that we had put in place anticipated that we would utilize the $600 million corpus to create ongoing revenue that would help, as the TIF cliff occurred, it would help offset those losses. And so the reduction right now...
Oh. I'm sorry, Kimberly, I missed the word in there. You said you thought you would use the $600 million what?
The $600 million corpus, or the $600 million that Tony mentioned, we anticipated using some portion of that for investments, similar to the Convention Center Hotel Garage, that would offset and throw off resources that could help offset the decline in TIF. So the COVID economic shock has had an unforeseen impact that is even outside of when we've stress tested it. So I think we want to put it out there and let you know that we aren't sure yet what the full impact is going to be. But this is something that we are going to be looking at really seriously, and we'll be coming back to our board and to City Council with some options as we have more information about what the actual program income decline is. So I think that's where we are right now.
Thank you, Commissioner Udaly.
I don't have questions about the forecast. I have questions and comments about the use of the cannabis tax dollars. So is this the right time to begin?
We're happy to take any questions. Our presentation is over. I know we do have Joe Brickman from our Community Budget Committee who is prepared to share her perspective, but we're happy to take any questions that you might have.
Great. Well, as a commissioner in charge of civic life, which is where the cannabis office is housed, and as someone very committed to restorative justice and very proud of the work that we've done in the cannabis office to advance. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Kimberly's frozen on my screen, so to advance social equity and restorative justice, I have some concerns about how this money will be used. I'm certainly also a big advocate for small business, and I want to see as many dollars as possible roll out through our small business relief fund, but this to me feels like robbing Peter to pay Paul. The projects we're funding through the cannabis grants are targeted at communities who have been disproportionately impacted by our past cannabis laws. And the need for expungement, the need for rental assistance for people coming out of the criminal justice system, none of those things go away because we're in the midst of a crisis, and they're all equally important. And this is our sole source of funding for those types of efforts. So here are my questions. How will the Small Business Relief Fund comply with the funding priorities of the cannabis tax ballot measure? Number one.
Thanks, Commissioner. So the tax ballot measure, as I understand it, supports for small businesses from communities and individuals who've been adversely impacted by the prohibition on cannabis and the war on drugs.
That's combining. It's actually support for small businesses, especially women and minority owned businesses. That's one item. And then it's economic opportunity and education to communities disproportionately impacted by cannabis prohibition, which is really what we have focused on with the cannabis grants.
Okay, thank you for the clarification. So I think that the Portland Small Business Relief Fund would align with the first of the two in particular by supporting businesses from communities who have been adversely impacted, so Black, Indigenous, people of color, as well as women. We would anticipate that the diversity of recipients would be in line with what we have seen in the first tranche of investments. So as we showed, 90% of recipients came from communities of color. One of the things that we had talked about internally was to the degree to which we wanted to add a follow-on question about whether people had themselves directly experienced any incarceration or any adverse impacts because of cannabis prohibition. I think we have not yet determined whether that would be advisable, and we'd want to work with our partners at New Leaf and others to determine how best to reach specific businesses. But certainly we would look to City Council for advice on that point.
Yeah, and I just want to say I was really impressed with Prosper's focus on equity as far as who you got those relief dollars out to initially. I in no way want to suggest that that's not important work or that you're not doing it right. It's just that by allocating all of these dollars to Prosper, it means that some of the more essential restorative justice work that we're funding with these dollars goes away, because we are trying to assist people who aren't ready to become entrepreneurs, who face barriers to entrepreneurship or employment or housing. And I don't believe that all of those dollars should solely be directed towards women and minority-owned businesses. If the dollars are entirely allocated to Prosper, they're going to represent about 40% of the small business relief fund. So will Prosper commit to awarding a minimum of 40% of the grants to businesses and individuals as defined in the ballot measure language?
Yes, I mean, we will exceed that if it's in line with what we had just talked about in terms of awarding to Black, Indigenous, people of color, and female-owned businesses. I think are, as I mentioned, sort of context of the 12,000 people, business owners who applied, more than half were business owners of color, and more than 60% were female entrepreneurs. And so there is a huge number of businesses who applied for these funds who would meet the criteria that have not yet received funding.
Okay. And my last question is really just for my colleagues to consider. You don't have to respond. Again, I support the Small Business Relief Fund. I've been hustling to do everything that I can for our small business, our local small businesses. But I am very uncomfortable with allocating all of these dollars for those purposes when we are funding really essential work that needs to be done in the community to repair past harms. So I would just ask that everyone consider whether this is the right allocation of these dollars, and consider that we have invested a lot of time and resources into developing this grant program and creating a equitable system for cannabis. That's all. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you, Mayor, and thank you, Commissioner Udaly. I assumed that we were going to, on a one-time basis, turn over some cannabis tax dollars to Prosper so that those dollars would get out of the door immediately, like within the next couple of weeks. I do not support giving all the cannabis tax dollars to Prosper because, as Kimberly knows, I've been troubled by the fact that all the business support pretty much comes out of cannabis dollars for businesses that are owned by communities of color and the work that Prosper has currently done. I mean, if you talk about the Neighborhood Prosperity Initiative and many of the other programs, they're funded through cannabis tax dollars. And we can debate whether or not these individual businesses have suffered harm from cannabis policy in the past or not. We can have that conversation, but I am not, I do not want all cannabis tax dollars going to Prosper, because I think Prosper needs to have more than one source of funding to support organizations led by people of color. I was willing to do it on a one-time basis, but I am not willing to do it as an ongoing allocation to Prosper. So I also want to be very clear about that and want to clear up any confusion that I may have caused earlier when we were talking about cannabis tax dollars. And so I appreciate, I know that Prosper has excelled in getting small business relief dollars out, because I've been part of that work and I'm very proud to be part of that work. Pre-pandemic, I was already having these conversations with Prosper about their over-reliance on cannabis tax dollars. And so Kimberly knows this isn't a new conversation. This has been ongoing since I showed up at City Council. And so I would not support having all those tax dollars going to Prosper, because as Commissioner Udaly said, there are real community needs outside of small business support, and we should not be labeling all small businesses owned by people of color has somehow been impacted by cannabis policy. I think we sent a wrong message when that's where our business support comes from. So, thank you.
Any further questions at this juncture? Commissioner Fritz.
So I just have to say what I always say, in that it wasn't intended that it would be the particular people who had been impacted by cannabis prohibition, but rather the communities. And so it was never intended that people had to have been personally affected by cannabis prohibition in order to get support.
But that's why we pay for expungements, because those are people who have actually been impacted by previous poor cannabis policy. That's why we prioritize that. And that's why we prioritize providing job training assistance for people who have directly been convicted of cannabis-related activities. I don't think you can disconnect the two, especially in a city like Portland, where it's very easy to see what communities have been radically impacted by policy around marijuana. There's no question about what communities have been harmed and what communities need some help to get through that process to become ready to start a small business or do anything else.
And as we saw in the demographics, the people who have received the assistance are from the most impacted communities, which are the Black, Indigenous, Indigenous people and Latinx communities.
One has nothing to do with the other. Thank you, Commissioner.
All right. Does that complete your presentation, Director Brandon?
It does.
All right. Very good. So in a moment, we are going to get to public testimony. Before we do that, at the beginning of the meeting, I usually have legal counsel read the rules of decorum. If legal counsel could read those rules now before we get to public testimony. And Carla, that'll give you a couple of minutes to get the list organized.
And Mayor, just as yes. a reminder, I think we have Joe Brickman as invited testimony from the Community Budget Committee.
Ah, very good. Why don't we do this? Why don't we have legal counsel read the rules of order and decorum, and then we'll get to Joe.
Perfect, thank you.
Okay, to participate in council meetings, you may sign up in advance with the council clerk's office for communications to briefly speak about any subject. You may also sign up for public testimony on resolutions and the first readings of ordinances. The published council agenda is at portlandoregon.gov/auditor, and it contains information about how and when you may sign up for testimony while the city council is holding electronic meetings. Your testimony should address the matter being considered at the time. When testifying, please state your name for the record. Your address is not necessary. Please disclose if you are a lobbyist, and if you are representing an organization, please identify it. The presiding officer determines the length of testimony. Individuals generally have 3 minutes to testify unless otherwise stated. When your time is up, the presiding officer will ask you to conclude. Disruptive conduct such as shouting, refusing to conclude your testimony when your time is up, or interrupting others' testimony or council deliberations will not be allowed. If there are disruptions, a warning will be given that further disruption may result in the person being placed on hold or ejected for the remainder of the electronic meeting. And also please be aware that the city council meetings are recorded.
Very good, thank you. And Kimberly, is Joe the only invited testimony for today?
She is, yes.
Thank you. All right, Joe Berkman, you're up. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Mayor Wheeler and commissioners. My name is Joanna Berkman, I go by Joe. I'm the deputy director of Virtue Lab and the co-chair of the Prosper Portland Community Budget Committee. Thanks for the opportunity to provide brief testimony today on behalf of the 22 volunteers that serve along with me on the committee. Our team worked with Prosper Portland staff over the course of the fall and winter to become acquainted with the breadth of Prosper Portland's work, understand the implementation and the trajectory of the agency's strategic plan, to review your priorities as mayor, discuss draft Prosper Portland work plans, scrutinize draft budgets for both the general fund and TIF districts, and to submit our recommendations. And then the world turned upside down. Last week, our committee had the opportunity to be debriefed by Prosper Portland staff as to the mayor's proposed budget, ongoing relief and recovery planning efforts, and plans for CARES Act funding. We truly appreciate the proactive steps that have been taken to both speedily respond to the impacts of the pandemic, to plan for recovery, and to thoughtfully reposition the budget. Committee members share a common concern about maintaining the core programs that will continue to play a critical role in ensuring the resilience of our communities and the economy. And in light of this, we encourage the council to prioritize federal CARES resources to ensure these proven and successful programs are continue to be supported in their efforts to assist its businesses seeing the greatest impact from COVID-19. So thank you for allowing me to join you today, and best of luck.
Thank you, Joe. And I just have to say, I'm completely envious of your little office space.
I promise I'm not on a boat. I know it looks like I am.
Oh, no, it's awesome. It's totally cool. I love it. Thank you. But one of the positive things of the Zoom experience is you sort of get just a little micro look into people's personal lives, their artwork, their plants, sometimes their dog, their cat jumps into view.
I was a little worried that my dogs were going to make an appearance this afternoon.
We've seen it all. Trust me. We've seen it all. And you know, roommates unwittingly walking through in various stages of undress, but really cool looking place. And thank you for your leadership and your service. We appreciate it. Commissioner Fritz and then Commissioner Hardesty.
I'm sorry, I forgot to put my hand down.
Oh, no worries. Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you, Mayor, and thank you, where'd she go? Oh, Joe. Joe disappeared. Joe brought up a question that I think is really pertinent to this conversation. It's the, I guess I'm kind of concerned about how the Economic Impact Task Force work feeds into some of the decisions that the city council will be faced with. I think I heard Joe say something about investment of CARE Act dollars, and the city council, to my knowledge, has not had our work session on setting our priorities about how those dollars will be invested. And so it just raised a little warning sign for me about how the work of the task force, which I'm loving, how that work is separate from the work that the city council's deliberation will determine how we invest those dollars. So I just want to make sure there's not a disconnect between what people think we're doing as far as the economic task force work groups and what the reality is about where those decisions will be made.
Commissioner, I'm happy to answer that. And actually, just before this presentation, we were looking, we put together an infographic because we want to make sure that it's very clear. I think verbally, we've been very clear that city council makes determinations.
I do it every 2 weeks, but
yeah, no, exactly.
It scares me because this is assumption that yes. this work leads to funding. And I want to be yes. crystal clear that that is not at least my expectation
yeah.
yet.
Understood. So we'll share that and make sure that everybody involved has that information.
Great.
You're looking a little freaked out about that.
No, not at all. So that completes our invited testimony. Carla, how many people have signed up for public testimony?
We had 10 people register, but I see we have 5 on the line.
Okay, well, we our next item, it can't start till 3:30, so let's give them 3 minutes each. And if you could just call them in their respective order, and we would ask everybody as you come online just to state your name for the record. That'd be super helpful. Thank you.
Okay, the first person is David Kress.
Good afternoon, David.
Hello. Hello, Mayor and council members. My name is David Kress. I'm one of the producers of the show Shrill and Documentaries Now. Today, I'd like to talk to you a bit about the history of the Portland Film Office and what a success that office has been. Let me say, just to start, a thank you to you and your staffs and the employees of the city and Prosper Portland for the leadership that you're providing in these extraordinary times. We really appreciate it. Thank you. It almost seems in a way trivial to be spending time talking about such a tiny item on the city's overall budget, given the circumstances. However, we do think cutting the film office would be an extraordinary mistake and the wrong move, especially in light of what's likely going to be tremendous downward pressure on the city and state's economy. As a proud Portlander, I've been involved in the Portland film community since long before the Portland Film Office was created. In fact, the last time I appeared before council was in 2002 when the film office was created. I provided some testimony then. Back in 2000, the city council recognized that the film industry could be very beneficial in diversifying our local economy. States and cities were competing for the good living wage jobs with health care and retirement benefits the film industry provided. The city wanted the knock-on effect to other businesses and tourism that the film industry could bring. They appreciated that this diverse economic element could be brought to the city with little investment in infrastructure. They knew what we needed was a faster response to permitting requests and more coordination between bureaus and regional coordination with the state's divisions, especially the Tri-County area where the lion's share of the business was generated. They also could see that the local indigenous media ecosystem would benefit from the additional equipment and expertise that these large outside productions brought to the city. They really had it right. Since 2005, we know we have generated over $1.5 billion of economic activity in the region. All that, and the city does not have to pave one road or install one street light for us. The industry has helped shine a bright light on the city's attractions and been a big driver of visitors to the city. What's even more important now, in this time of likely recession, that the film and video industry will more than pull its weight by jumpstarting some of the industries hit hardest by this pandemic. The Shrill Show that I produced alone last year in season 2 spent $350,000 on hotel rooms and restaurants. Our Portland payroll was $5.6 million, and we spent $240,000 on rental car taxes and parking. Drilling down on that, one highlight is we paid the city of Portland $22,000 for permits. We know that if the Portland Film Office is eliminated, the city will still host some shows, but unfortunately, there's still not a practical way to coordinate the film permitting process without people. If the office is eliminated, we know our reputation as a great place to shoot will be degraded. I'd also like to point out that the Portland Film Office has been involved in role in helping us to create the protocols that will allow us to return to work quickly and safely. We thank Brian Lord for that. Every mayor since Beer Katz has realized there's a need for this office and retained it. Please work with us to find a way to continue this office and its important work. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David. And David, I wanna personally thank you for all of your contributions and volunteerism in the community. Appreciate it, appreciate you being here today. Commissioner Hardesty and Commissioner Fritz, did you have comments on this, or is that like?
No, I failed to put my hand down.
Commissioner Fritz, did you have a comment?
I actually do. I just wanted to say thank you for producing Shrill. It's one of my daughter's favorite shows, and I understand the economic benefit of having the film office. I know that the mayor does too, and I'll be looking forward to discussing what the plans are for continuing to support the film industry.
Thank you, David. Appreciate it. Carla, next individual, please.
Next is Lisa Sikala.
Welcome, Lisa.
Thank you. So my name is Lisa Chakala, and I am the executive director of the Oregon Media Production Association, and I'm testifying today as well on the behalf of the Portland Film Office, which is not included in the proposed budget. OMPA represents the working professionals in the film, television, commercial, and immersive media industry, and these professionals represent everyone from producers and writers to construction workers and caterers. In 2002, our organization was instrumental in helping to establish the Portland Film Office because, as David said, the industry recognized that that's what was needed in order to attract more production to the city, and it has paid off. Since then, the membership in our organization has grown 7 times to over 2,000 members, indicating that there are many more professionals working living wage jobs in this industry today. This growth in jobs did not happen by accident, but rather is due to consistent support from our city's leaders to ensure that Portland is a film-friendly city. And this reputation is due in large part to the Portland Film Office. Productions and producers like producing their work in Portland, which means that the same companies bring multiple projects back to the city over several years. And we just cannot afford to go backwards and lose the investment the city's made that has gotten us to where we are today. I spoke to one of the small businesses that works in our industry, Mundo Catering, and just after the pandemic shut down production. They're a husband and wife, minority-owned business, who are the caterers of choice for many of the shows that shoot here in Portland. The majority of their business comes from serving film and television production, so when the pandemic hit, they lost all of their work. Sarah and Javier told me that food businesses run with so much overhead and such slim profit margins anyway that this absolutely decimated us. Sadly, that happened at a time when they welcomed a baby just 2 weeks ago. Their business depends on productions choosing to film in Portland, and productions choose to film in Portland because they have good experiences here due to the Portland Film Office. And Mundo Catering just can't afford to see productions go elsewhere to cities that are recognized as more welcoming to film and television. Another member of OMPA, Kerner Camera, provides cameras and lenses to the major productions that come to town. And while, yes, Michael Kerner's business and his employees depend on those productions choosing Portland, the entire industry benefits from that business. Because of a consistent, reliable workflow, they are then able to generously provide high-end camera gear to independent filmmakers and artists to tell their stories. They're able to provide mentorship to help elevate more diverse workforce via the Oregon Media Pathways Program. They're able to offer scholarships and internships to PSU students. And they're able to support local film festivals that elevate artists and ultimately draw tourism dollars to the city. So when productions come to Portland, students, artists, and people of color also have more opportunities. We can't take for granted what we've built up here over the years. There are no guarantees that production will continue to spend money here and create jobs in this city unless we protect what we've built. I ask that you not shut down the Portland Film Office in just over a month's time, that you consider alternatives. It's a small but mighty office that has a large impact on our industry's ability to support high quality, living wage jobs and put money directly into businesses across the city and aid in its economic recovery. Thank you. And thank you for your leadership during these challenging times.
Thank you, Lisa. Appreciate your testimony.
Next is C. David Cottrell.
Welcome.
Hello, everyone. Good afternoon, Mayor, and afternoon, Mayor and Commissioners. I am C. David Cottrell. I'm a property master by trade in the film and TV business. I'm also the business agent for IATSE Local 488 for the Studio Mechanics of the Pacific Northwest. Thank you for allowing me to testify in support of maintaining funding for the Portland Film Office. And thank you also for the important work that you're doing right now to make Portland, keep Portland a great place to work and to live. IATSE 488 represents the crew working behind the camera on movies, TV, streaming projects, commercials, and other film and digital media projects. Our members work in 19 different crafts, including production and office accountants, construction and paint, props and set dressing, hair and makeup, medics, and more. Our members literally manufacture entertainment for the world. Our jurisdiction covers Oregon, Washington, Montana, and Idaho. Portland crew base is currently 261 people. In the Portland metro and Vancouver area, we have a total of 341 members. IATSE Local 600, the camera crew, has 75 members. SAG-AFTRA has over 1,000 actors as members. Directors Guild has over 40 members. And the Teamsters have 115 members working locally in our industry. As our union work has grown over the past decade, so too has the larger freelance crew base. This group of people includes non-union folks who work alongside our union members on non-union projects in motion picture, stop-motion animation, commercial advertising, independent film, and other digital media. These are solid family wage jobs with benefits for the citizens of Portland and the citizens of Oregon. We understand deeply the financial crisis we face as a city, state, and nation. Our media industry itself suffered a complete shutdown as of March 13th, canceling or postponing thousands of workdays scheduled for projects already in production. In addition, the shutdown has meant the postponement of multiple large projects planned to be here through the end of the year. However, with the national demand for streaming content, we know that once it is safe to do so, we will be back to work on those projects in a minute, and other projects will be coming to Portland. Shutting down the Portland Film Office now will severely hamper our ability to jumpstart our industry. To give you a little bit of a lens on the damage that would be done, here are some projects which would not have been fully realized without the participation of the Portland Film Office. As the city's liaison between its bureaus and our industry, the Portland Film Office effectively uses its limited resources to support both individual projects as well as other important pieces of our ecosystem. To name a few, the Portland Film Office has been an active collaborator with OMPA, Oregon Film, and the unions and guilds in developing the following. The Oregon Media Pathways Program, which is our equity and inclusion-based workforce development project. Portland Film Office also established a working group made up of industry professionals, local colleges, and community groups to enhance education and training programs for the next generation of Portland media makers. The Film Office helped fund safety on set events and trainings open to the entire digital media industry. And most recently, the Portland Film Office has been instrumental in working with industry partners to establish our regional and state COVID-19 protocols for our industry to safely return to work. There will be much planning and training necessary for our industry's restart. I hope our testimony and the 2,800 responses to the petition that we put online demonstrate that we have a media industry community and a community at large that needs the city of Portland as a stakeholder in our industry now more than ever. And for our ecosystem to successfully revive and thrive, we need the Portland Film Office by our side. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, appreciate your testimony.
Sorry here. Next is Michael Martin.
Welcome, Michael.
Okay. Okay, you there?
Yep, we hear you loud and clear.
Right. If I may decline at this time and give my spot to the next.
Certainly. Carl, the next individual, please.
Next is Tim Williams.
Hi there. My name is Tim Williams. I'm the Executive Director of Oregon Film, the State Film and Media Office, and I'm testifying today again also on behalf of the Portland Film Office. Thank you for having me, and thank you for all that you do and Prosper Portland do for this city during this really hard time. It is much appreciated by all of us. The film, television, and media industry in this state has been steadily growing for the past 20 years, and the Portland Film Office has been an integral part of that growth. For the 2017-2019 biennium, we tracked $280 million of direct spending, impacting 4,000 jobs per year. During this current fiscal year, we're tracking about $150 million of direct spending, impacting 3,000 jobs over 42 different projects. At least 30 of those projects, equating to $135 million of local spending, are based and shot in the Portland metro area. This industry is going to return quickly and safely, providing a very high rate of local employment, spending on local vendors, and providing notoriety and tourism for the city in the long term. At least three television series are in line to restart production in Portland later this summer, as and when procedures and protocols are put in place to make them do that safely. There are more productions waiting. This industry will be the leading edge of recovery, just as it has been the only source of content that literally everyone is consuming right now. It will thrive. This was clearly shown during the last recession. Each of these productions utilizes a wide range of local vendors, including hard-hit areas like hotels, restaurants, and small businesses, and the Portland Film Office is an additive measure for Prosper Portland's COVID-19 response, a place where Prosper Small Business Relief Fund will be amplified many times over by just one production. By way of example, the second season of the Netflix series Trinkets spent $100,000 just on travel booked through a local travel company, $140,000 in catering costs from a local caterer, and $32,000 paid directly to the city of Portland. While the feature film Timmy Failure spent $4 million in the city employing more than 400 people in just over a month of shooting. While I acknowledge that the budget note about the film office put in place 2 years ago completely closing down the film office now during a budget note from 2 years ago doesn't make sense from a mission or economic perspective right now. We're now operating in a very different reality, and we need to be finding constructive and creative solutions to preserve this work and momentum. I am working through these same issues with my office on the state level. Without the Portland Film Office, Portland becomes a more difficult place for local and outside producers to produce work. What is now a three-day turnaround for city property users will turn into a much less workable process. Productions and producers track this and make decisions based on ease of use and processes that make HD of day filming easier and safer to arrange. The Film Office is also a very valued community partner, as you've heard. Our work together has included providing numerous grants for local productions to finish their projects here in Portland, as well as specific, equitable, and diverse workforce development and job opportunity creation on the sets and in the studios producing work here in the city. In short, this office of one person has made Portland the place to produce creative content here in the Northwest United States, and I ask you, please don't eliminate this small but highly effective office that does so much for the community, the industry, and the city here in Portland. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. Commissioner Hardesty, and then Commissioner Davis.
Thank you, Mayor, and thank you, Tim, for your testimony. So here's my question. I can still say I'm the new kid on the block until somebody else shows up on the Portland City Council. When I first arrived, I was under the impression that last year the office was going to figure out how to self-fund itself. My colleague, Nick Fish, advocated venomously that we give you one more year, give the office one more year to be able to identify that funding. I'm a little offended that we're being told that we're shutting down the office. And in fact, we're not shutting down the office. There's no one on the city council that doesn't think the office is critical. But I have to ask, what have you done, Tim, to help identify additional funding resources so that that office could be maintained without being dependent on very precious general fund dollars?
Any response to that?
Oh, sorry. I didn't know if I was unmuted. My apologies.
Yeah, no worries.
Commissioner Hardesty, yes, I believe that was the intention. I think with Commissioner Fish's passing, we lost somebody that we were working very closely with on the inside of City Council. And I know Brian Lord, who runs the film office, was trying very hard to find ways to put in place full financing of that. And maybe that is, you know, the next step is how do we find a way to make this 100% financing? But I think both the current crisis we are in, as well as Commissioner Fish's passing, has made it a little bit harder for that equation to sort of be met in the time frame that we wanted it to be met on. And I fully acknowledge that that was the intention for sure.
Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner Udaly. Mute.
Thank you, Mayor. I want to thank everyone for coming to testify on behalf of the film office. This is a conversation that I'm also very interested in. When I had BDS, I was interested in creating a film, music, and festival office. I don't have BDS any longer, but I do have PBOT, which interacts with your industry quite a bit. Unfortunately, my PBOT liaison is out sick today, so I haven't been able to get timely information back during this conversation, but I have a vague recollection that there was conversation about increasing those permit fees to make the office self-funding, and I believe that the conclusion was that those permits might become cost prohibitive, but I'm going to have to follow up with staff on that to see where we're at. We certainly don't want to lose your industry. We appreciate everything you bring to Portland, and it's, you know, you're another critical piece of our overall arts and creative economy. So thank you.
Thank you. Next, Carla, please.
The next person is Ahmad Santos.
Welcome, Ahmad.
Hello. Can you, I can be heard, yes?
Yep, loud and clear.
Perfect. So, I mean, I just really am adding to what a lot of other people have already said, which is that our industry draws from so many other industries in this town, in this city. And so I feel like shutting us down or keeping us at a point where we're not able to operate efficiently is really at a detriment to everyone's growth. Because even just within my team, I wear costumes. And even just within our team, we're always seeking out local designers, exposing, you know, new lines, new people who are starting businesses and helping them grow even further beyond just the means of Portland. So therefore, I feel like our industry just brings so much attention to Portland and allows us to grow as a city and not just within our own industry. And that's pretty much all I have to add.
Thank you, Ahmad. Appreciate your testimony.
I believe that's all, unless Michael Martin was going to speak. He seemed to have declined. But
yeah, Michael, did you want to speak, or are you good to go? He may have signed off. All right, very good. As you know, we're not taking a vote today. Anything else before we move this on, colleagues? Commissioner Hardis, do I see your hand? But I think that was left up from last time.
That is correct. My apologies.
Very good. All right. This meeting of the Prosper Portland Budget Committee now adjourns, but we will reconvene on May 20th, 2020 to take action and approve the Prosper Portland budget. I'd like to thank Director Branham, Lisa Abwaff, and of course, Chair Cruz for all of your great leadership and for giving us this presentation today. Thanks to you and your entire team.
Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you. It is now three. Thank you. Appreciate it very much. We will take a brief recess. We will reconvene at 3:30 for the time certain item. We're in recess.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, we're back in session. It looks like everybody's on board. Carla, could you please read time certain item 373?
Mm-hmm. Authorize $548,094 total in grant funds for the 2020 Cannabis Social Equity Grant Program in the Office of Community and Civic Life.
Commissioner Udaly.
Thank you, Mayor. Good afternoon, everyone. As the Commissioner in charge of the Office of Community and Civic Life, it's a pleasure to introduce this year's recommendations for the 2020 Cannabis Social Equity Grants. This is the second year of Civic Life Social Equity Grant Program, and I'm pleased to see how the program has evolved over the past couple years. Portland is one of the first jurisdictions with a legal cannabis market to allocate our revenue to restorative justice, and our program serves as a model for the rest of the country, and I'm really proud of it. I'm looking forward to reviewing these projects today, and now I'm going to turn it over to Kimye Uyoka and Michael Montoya and Christina Corsi from Civic Life to present on the Cannabis Social Equity Grants. Welcome, everyone. Nice to see your faces.
Thank you. Good afternoon, commissioners. Good afternoon, Mayor. Thank you, commissioners, and thank you, Mayor. It seems that thank yous aren't quite enough. It is truly a thankless job, the sacrifices that you have to make of your time, energy, and commitment, although it probably doesn't feel that way because you're so dedicated. I just want to personally thank you, as others have today. My name is Michael Montoya. I am the Strategy, Innovation, and Performance Manager for the Bureau of Community and Civic Life. I also want to thank Christina Corsi and Kimye Uyoka, our staff in the cannabis program, for their heroics to stand this grant process up this year. And you'll be hearing from them in a minute. We are here today to briefly present work and lessons from years one and two of the grant program, and to request approval on the recommended projects and programs for year three. We hope that we can return at a later date to fully present and celebrate the work of the grant-funded projects and partner organizations. As you know, state and national statistics show that enforcement of cannabis laws has been experienced disproportionately by our communities of color and, to a greater extent, by our Black and Indigenous communities. For the past 80 years, social and political pressures intensified the criminalization of cannabis and led to regulatory policies that were often rooted in fear and in racism. These policies have had devastating legal, social, and economic impacts for many individuals and their families, and have added to intergenerational harm experienced by our communities of color. This grant program recognizes the damages caused by cannabis prohibition and the restorative justice potential of legalization. As stated in the funding announcement, these funds are meant to repair harm, restore justice, and create pathways to wealth and power for communities that have borne the brunt of unjust cannabis laws. I will now hand it off to Kimye Uyoka.
Thank you, and I apologize. I'm gonna share my screen. We have a PowerPoint that goes along with this. Hold on just one moment, please. Hello, my name is Kimye Uyoka. I am the Policy and Grants Coordinator for the City's Cannabis Program. I'm going to share a bit about the last two cycles and this year's grant making. When Portland voters approved ballot measure 26180 by nearly 80%, they intended for funds to be put towards targeted reinvestment, specifically in communities who've been disproportionately impacted by cannabis prohibition. This grant program speaks directly to that intention. To date, nearly $1 million has been distributed through these grants. The fund has supported 34 community expungement clinics, over 2,000 legal analyses for expungement, and more than 270 Portlanders have received specialized workforce training and career development support free of charge. All programs, apart from Metropolitan Public Defender Services, reported that 70 to 90% of their participants are from our grant priority communities. And although MPD's percentage is below that, closer to 40%, they alone have served more than 10 times the number of individuals identifying as Black, Indigenous, or persons of color than any of the other grantees. I need to note that these numbers do not include grants administered by Prosper or the final numbers for our year two grants, which are going now and will end next month, all of whom are continuing to serve to the best of their abilities during the COVID-19 crisis. In year three, the grant and priority funding areas were informed by stakeholder engagement through the Cannabis Programs Advisory Body, the Cannabis Policy Oversight Team, and stakeholder feedback from year two listening sessions, year two grant applicants, year three cannabis community talks, information from city, regional and national efforts in criminal justice reform and community economic development. This graphic shows a timeline of this year's grant-making process. We started our conversations with the community in late October. The grant application period opened in mid-December, and we had four information sessions out in different sectors of the city of Portland. The funding announcement closed at the end of January, and then the review panelists began their individual review and scoring. As you can see, the COVID-19 crisis emerged right at the mid to tail end of the independent review, and we have spent the second half of the grant making process responding and supporting our panelists in responding to that crisis. In year three, this cycle, we received 31 applications asking for close to $3 million in need. Since assuming responsibility for this grant, Civic Life has seen the number of applicants increase from 9 to 30. After last cycle, adjustments were made to grant making and community engagement to encourage a more proportionate pool of applicants. This year, we saw increases in applications across all funding areas except workforce development. Grant applications were reviewed independently and collaboratively by a community majority review panel. The review panel is made of seven individuals, five appointed by you, commissioners, one cannabis advisory body member, and one city staff with funding area expertise. Since assuming administration of this grant, we have worked to ensure that the composition of the review panel is reflective of both the grant's priority funding areas and the service communities. This cycle, one panelist was forced to withdraw just before the collaborative scoring meeting due to personal reasons related to COVID-19. As we managed our own challenges presented by COVID, we were also acutely aware of the impact that this was likely having and would continue to have on our reviewers and our current and future grantees. Our first step was to reach out to staff, panelists, awardees, applicants, and our own advisory group to better understand the impact that COVID-19 was having on them and ask them for guidance. Based on their feedback, we decided to move forward with the grant-making process. At the review panel's online meeting, rather than jump right into scoring, we started the meeting by first asking the panel for guidance around this fundamental question: how should this grant fund respond to the current crisis? The panel discussed a variety of options for recommendation. They considered narrowing the priority areas in order to focus on a single area, and even considered dividing the funds equally amongst all the applicants and recommending that 100% go towards general operating costs. It was a lengthy and difficult conversation for the panel. Ultimately, the group decided to distribute funds across the funding areas to fund both small emerging community programs and to support their survival and ability to serve, but also fund larger, more established programs that would be more likely to get funds and services out into the community quickly. They also accepted that they have a limited amount of information and that the funding landscape and the economy was likely to shift rapidly. They accepted that the scope of these projects and the capacity of these organizations was likely to change, and that they recommended the city offer awardees the maximum amount of flexibility possible so that they can respond to immediate community needs. The panel was also asked to consider these other questions in relationship to the current crisis.
Good afternoon. My name is Christina Corsi. I am the interim supervisor and the licensing coordinator of the cannabis program. Exhibit A of our council package includes a brief summary of each of the recommended projects. We are asking council for approval to move forward with generating grant agreements for these proposed projects. I'd like to share a few of the panel's recommendations for these proposals. Social justice program, Beyond Black. Beyond Black is a small community-based organization with important geographic placement for community members in East Portland. This project focuses on building community engagement, policy awareness, and social justice. The advocacy portion of this grant was well designed. The project plans to tackle an important community-led discussion around cannabis policy and equity. Minka program, Latino Network. The Minka program uses a proven model for full youth and family wraparound services to address youth gang involvement. This program has a valuable combination of direct services and advocacy to support and empower families. The program offers a strong leadership development opportunities and support for participants. Building Economic Power for Day Laborers, BOS Workers' Rights Education Project. This program provides workforce development and education for a high-need community that is unlikely to have access to federal emergency support programs. The program was developed through a strong model of participant-led organizational and program development. This program is a year two grant recipient. Construction pre-apprenticeship program for communities of color and low-income young adults. The construction pre-apprenticeship program application gave thorough information about how the program participants, who it serves, and community and individual level impact of the program so far. They also provided clear information about the existing need in the community for this program. This program is also a year one and year two grant recipient. Housing Support for Justice-Involved Portlanders Pursuing Middle-Income Careers, Work Systems. Housing Support for Justice-Involved Portlanders will provide emergency housing assistance funds for individuals exiting incarceration. The program provides integrated housing and employment services. 75% of program participants will be from Black, Indigenous, and communities of color. 90% of requested funds will be going directly to rent assistance. Portland Community College Community Legal and Educational Access and Referral Clinic, PCC Clear Clinic. PCC Clear Clinic will be based in North Portland and will host free legal clinics offering a variety of needed legal supports and services, including civil, immigration, housing, and expungement legal support. The program's relationship within PCC creates direct access to an extensive network of students, volunteers, resources, and wraparound support services for participants. The program will also include direct pathways to educational opportunities, and this program will also provide civic engagement and criminal justice reform experience for PCC legal students. Today, the Office of Community and Civic Life is requesting council approval to use $548,094 from fiscal year 1920 available grant funds to create grant agreements for these six projects, with the understanding that the economic landscape and community needs are shifting and intensifying daily. And this program intends to do what we can to be responsive through grant making. If we are able to receive funding to continue this work in the next fiscal year, there are some things we would like to improve upon. We would like to continue to improve grant design and grant making process, improve the understanding of impact of cannabis criminalization on participants, boost visibility of the fund and work of grantees, and expand internal and external relationships and community engagement. The end of cannabis prohibition is a rare opportunity with great potential to be reparative. Each cycle we learn from the community what's working and what's not, and we grow from this. I am excited to be part of this grant program and to partner with the communities we serve to help realize this potential. We thank you, commissioners and mayor, for your time, and we'd be happy to address any questions that you might have. Thank you.
Thank you. Very good. Colleagues, any questions? Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you, Mayor. And thank you both for that presentation. I don't know if I should address this to Kimmy or to Christina. I have some very specific questions about some of the individual grants that I hope you'll be able to answer. So the first one was Beyond Black, and you said they were going to host a series of community meetings around what you said something about a community meeting around cannabis impacts. Could you tell me a little bit more about that? Who are these people? Where you said they're in East Portland. Is this a 501c3 organization? Is this a brand new organization? I know nothing about them.
It's a young nonprofit organization that has just been, over the past year or two, gaining more of a foothold in outer East Portland. So they're right on the border of Gresham and Portland. They're serving a lot of community members who have been pushed out to Far East. And what they originally had proposed was a much larger and kind of multifaceted program that would include more direct assistance with reentry. But the panel, the review panel, really thought that the more well-formed and ready to deliver piece of their work was around the policy advocacy and community engagement. So part of so what was offered to them and they were invited to do through this grant was to flesh out and do the project around focusing on that piece around building building community awareness and also building community knowledge of how to access and get involved in political processes, as well as also exploring with the community as part of that cannabis policy and equity as it relates to reinvestment of the cannabis funds.
My second question has to do with Work Systems, Inc., which is the workforce development entity in the region, which gets significant money to work with the populations that we are about to give them grants to work with. And I'm just wondering, out of all the opportunities we had, why that one rose to the top for a significant level of funding, just knowing what their resources are that they already have access to. And if you compare them to Beyond Black, right, it's like one has access to a multitude of resources and one probably has access to almost no resources. And so it seems a very bizarre mix.
Yeah, the review panel, first of all, I have to say that the review panel met on April 2nd. On April 2nd, the landscape was shifting even more quickly than it is now, as far as what was going to be available, what money was going to be going out to who at both the local and federal level. So there's that piece to their decision making. So I'll start with the Work Systems. The thinking around Work Systems was that Work Systems is established and has mechanisms in place and was asking in their proposal for the lion's share of the money to go directly to rent assistance, that they were only asking for the amount allowable for admin and overhead, and that $130,000 of what they were asking for was going to directly go to rent assistance. So,
excuse me, do they have a history of doing direct rental assistance with populations like folks coming back from incarceration? Because I don't think they have a good success record at that based on information that I know about what they are, what the community perceives them to be experts at and what they perceive them to get money for, but not necessarily have the kind of outcomes. So And I don't expect you to know, but if you have some analysis around whether or not they're effective, right? I mean, it's one thing to say, because I would think that POIC, I would think Constructing Hope would be two organizations that had a more direct relationship with that population than, say, Work Systems Inc. So it just seemed bizarre to me. So looking forward to response.
I can speak to that a little. Yes, they have had ongoing rental assistant programs for people coming out of incarceration. And what they found was that the short-term assistance typically available to people coming out of the system did not allow them to complete the programs that they were in, and led to a significantly lower success rate for those individuals who lost that support. So my understanding is it's really targeted at funding the gap between the length of temporary assistance typically available and the length of those programs that get people workforce training and up and ready to go out and find their own housing. That's my understanding.
I guess my biggest concern is they get all the federal workforce dollars to address that population. So my concern is putting it all in one pot. I mean, they already get all the federal dollars and any regional dollars that come in. And unless they made a compelling argument, and of course I've seen none of the grants, that somehow giving them over $100,000 is gonna make them more effective with that population, I would just be very concerned.
I don't know that any of the other grant applications were for rental assistance for justice-involved individuals. I can't speak to that. I can say that although it sounds like one pot, they have struggled on an ongoing basis to find money for that supplemental rental assistance that I was referring to. So even though they may be getting the lion's share of federal dollars, those dollars apparently are not adequate to cover the needed rental assistance.
Thank you all for those responses. I admire the work that you did. I appreciate the shift that had to happen after the pandemic hit. If possible, I know that today is the first reading, or are we accepting a report?
First reading.
I would be very interested in actually reading the proposals that you're recommending we fund, because I know in this venue, we are not gonna be able to get the totality of the picture. And I don't wanna waste time asking a lot of questions that I could answer for myself if I read the proposal. So thank you.
Very good.
If I might say, we are in the process right now of working with these six applicants to make immediate adjustments to what was originally proposed, given that those proposals were written way back prior to COVID. And so we're working with them as we speak, and all of our year two grantees as well, in order to make sure that they're what they're asking for and that what they're proposing is responsive as they identify it to what the community they're working with needs most.
Thanks, Kimmy. Very good. Any further questions before we move into public testimony? Great. Excellent presentation. Good conversation. Carla, do we have people signed up for public testimony?
No one signed up, Mayor.
Nobody signed up. All right. Anything else for the good of the order? Thank you all. This is a first reading of a non-emergency ordinance. It moves to second reading, and we are adjourned.